Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the digital finance pioneer and first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. In this episode of The Gauge, Sean Kiernan speaks to Marcel Kazimovic, Deputy CIO of Coinbase. Marcel shares his journey in the world of finance and cryptocurrency and discusses with Sean the development of a permissioned DeFi platform, the potential societal impacts of blockchain technology, and particularly how micropayments might revolutionize the gig economy and personal finance management. Marcel also highlights the efficiency of stablecoins and their role in the future of banking.
Welcome to another episode of The Gauge. I'm honored and delighted actually to have a friend, Marcel Kazimovic, with us today. Marcel's the deputy CIO at Coinbase, which is quite a big position. He's currently based in the UAE in Abu Dhabi. He's just moved recently the last 2 months. Marcel, welcome.
Oh, absolute pleasure and honor to be here, sir. Really, really pleased.
You're kind of a big cheese. I'm intrigued as well. Not just that you're here of your own accord, given that you're so busy these days, but I'd be delighted to hear a little bit more about your background. I know you've got a storied career, but what brought you to the UAE and how did you end up at Coinbase?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I like to think of it a little bit differently. I like to think average guy, non-average circumstances, you know, it's and I mean that in a sincere way. I mean, I try to emphasize to people, I give a lecture to the University of Columbia on the weekend and everyone wants to know, okay, so how do you go down this journey and do it? The way I try to characterize it, the knock of opportunity is as soft as the sound of your heartbeat, right? It's not thumping at the door saying, hey, come over here. This is a great chance. And it's only ex post that we tell the story. So ex post, if you look at all the things I've done, you're like, yeah, geez, you know, this guy had a plan. And it's quite the contrary. I followed my instincts, followed my interests, dug deep on everything I did. And it has been, I feel like the Forrest Gump of finance at some level, you know, it's like, I've just kind of stumbled into some really, really interesting positions. And I've worked very hard at it too, don't get me wrong, but I love what I do. So yeah, I ended up in the UAE based on a tool we were building that was principally going to be used as permission DeFi, if you will. And we thought largely in North America, that would be the natural starting point, but principally the United States, built by Canadians born in America. And then FTX happens and everything kind of tightens up. We then broadened our reach into the global regulatory world and ADGM knocked on the door. And I literally didn't know what ADGM stood for. I'd never been to the UAE. So this is like, I'm like, and I was very honest about it, which they all found amusing. So they assumed, having read our paper, they assumed that I had studied their paper, which I had. And then I went back and studied their paper on similar tools. And it was just a match made in heaven. So we really hit it off from that point. And then to gain regulatory approval for an on-chain marketplace in the UAE, led by Coinbase and Coinbase Asset Management, for that to happen, you need some form of senior presence here. And here I am. So on October the 2nd, I landed in the UAE, and it's been a whirlwind since. It's been great.
Can you give us a little bit more color about, I mean, this sounds fascinating, a DeFi-based backend marketplace. What are you looking to post on this?
Yeah, so here's how it came to fruition. We were building asset management products, including a credit product. And in building the credit product, a lot of the attention was at the time, it was a bull market. So a lot of the attention at the time was on DeFi and leveraging up to gain tremendous yield. As we dug into that, we recognized that the technologies for bringing the users and providers of capital together were tremendous. I mean, the fact that this stuff is working was tremendous. So we were incredibly intrigued. But the degree of the yield that you could get relative to a risk-free rate or even a risk-free rate inside of the digital ecosystem was disproportionate. So there were hidden risks in there. We evaluated those hidden risks and we said, look, this is interesting, but this is not institutional. So we took a very conservative path on the credit side. We didn't suffer any losses in 2022, for example. What we did in the interim, when crypto winter hits, we say, okay, we actually have something to contribute in this DeFi space. And I think of it a little bit more broadly as just an on-chain marketplace, because there's so many tools that are ultimately now being fused together. It's a little bit broader than just DeFi. And the way we ultimately thought of it, we said, look, anonymity is impossible or to achieve scale. So if you want to achieve scale, you're going to have to enter the regulatory mainstream. To enter the regulatory mainstream, you're going to need to respect privacy, but anonymity's out. So then think of the permission layer of these decentralized tools as a layer defined by regulators. So you're effectively giving the keys to the car to the regulator to say who belongs in what pool. Now, over time, and those rules become clearer and clearer, those are going to be decentralized too. They're just going to be a smart contract defined by the regulator, and that can be integrated into a complete DeFi picture. So that was our first step. We said, look, we're going to approach this as saying, we're going to bring it to the regulators, say, here's what we built. Now you can define the regulatory perimeter. Great. Everybody respects that. Now, the second thing that we did is not to build moats. So we very much respect the tech layer, but anybody should be able to use this tech stack. So if you want to issue capital, if you want to buy assets, whatever it may be, you should be able to use this tech stack freely. So it's built to pull a network of people together, as opposed to inside a specific bank, they might build it to attract more clients into that bank. So there's a regulatory perimeter and then an additional perimeter that says you need to be our bank client to use these tools. So we're thinking of this in more generalized form. So we think we have a very, very unique position where we can now achieve some form of scale with these tools.
I mean, it's fascinating to think that there's not just a red carpet, but an olive branch from a regulator to think about these concepts. And it's great to hear AGGM is thinking that far ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think their emphasis is very much on thinking global. And if you think of the size of the place, it makes a lot of sense. And we're building something that we think can serve as the world across all assets. So when we think of it, we think of it as digitally native assets. So we're not just tokenizing, which is taking an existing asset and then just putting it on chain. Digitally native assets, which is where the efficiencies come in. So you can see the universe is operating in parallel. And then all of a sudden the unlock is, okay, you can issue a bond on this for sure, but you can also issue carbon credits, clean energy certificates, IP. There's a host of things you can do that don't exist right now in tradable or digestible investment forms that can be done on this platform. And it's done with a front end that's very user-friendly. So it's super exciting. I mean, the spirit of what we built, the question that we asked ourselves is, how do you build something that scales to 8 billion people, right? And you start with one. That's the answer. It's always the answer. You start with one. And we were the one. You know, we played around with this for 2 years before we got to the stage now where it's ready to go. So it's been a lot of fun.
I mean, I love that not only have you done the homework, but you're given your own personal background. I'm not going to go to the weeds, but you've done the time in big finance. You've done the time within setting up your own firm. And now you're in a pretty reputable house in Coinbase doing something extremely innovative. I'd love to hear what got you excited about the crypto space in the first place.
Oh, what a journey. Everyone has their own story, you know? I think I was exposed to Bitcoin through a science magazine, and I was just intrigued. You know, it's one of those things. Everyone's had those moments where they're, you know, sitting on a plane, you're just flipping through something. You're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And it was about the future of money. So the first job that I ever had, first real job I ever had was at the Bank of Canada. And the first task that I had was understanding what is money. And I thought, well, that's a really hard question. It's a central bank and you can't even answer that question. We got a long way to go here. And of course, I thought of it as cash in my wallet. And then as you dug deeper, like anything, it's way more complicated. So I felt like I had a pretty good understanding of money credit. I felt like I had a really good understanding of financial plumbing, you know, lived through some financial crisis. So I'm like, what's this stuff? Future of money, come on. And it literally took me, I just stuck with it. And it took me probably 5 years, I think, to really understand what the point was. And I just became enamored with this, with the technology stack. That's what it, and I'm not a technologist. I'm not a computer scientist. I sat there and said, okay, so what are we really doing here? We're breaking down barriers between users and providers of capital in the truest sense. And anytime you break down those barriers, you get a much cleaner and clearer distribution of capital. It's just better for everyone, except for the intermediary. So how can that not be an optimal state of the world? Where I really struggled with this idea that Bitcoin was going to be the ultimate numeraire. And I thought that could be true, but didn't have to be true. And then the advent of stablecoin really solidified it for me, because once you saw stablecoin start to be adopted on these rails, you're like, okay, you can build anything on these rails. Then I start thinking about Bitcoin as fed wire. It's slow with purpose. It's supposed to be slow. And then you build the fast switch stuff above it. Then Lightning Network kicks in 2015, 16. And then I had it. I had a mental map of what this thing could become. And then, of course, then it's unshakable. Then you participate financially. Then you end up with a portfolio that's personally heavily skewed toward cryptos. You're spending more of your mental energy on how that integrates and all these things. And then before you know it, you're deputy CIO of the asset management, you know? So it's, yeah, I just keep pulling on thread. So I really, it's been a really fun. They're very different from, I would say, the crypto natives. Certainly they were all very open, but I really appreciate about the community. Anytime I had questions, I got answers, which I loved. But sometimes the answers were a bit harsh, right? Like things like, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, that's true. That's why I'm asking these primitive questions. I recognize my failures right now. But with time and patience and, you know, and just digging, you know, you figure stuff out. Just take time.
I don't know anybody that would call you an idiot, Marcel. But I also love, I mean, you have a gift in a way for also interlocuting between this space and mainstream finance. I know you've handheld quite a few institutional investors to come in. What do you think is the art? Is this something that you think direction of travel is always going to be more mainstream finance? Or how do you see that bridge happening?
It's a great question. Look, I've never tried to convince somebody of something. I think it's just, I think people will adopt it when they're ready. You know what I mean? And I think part of the frustration when you figure something out, it's kind of like this with parent and child. You figure something out and you're looking at the kid and you're like, well, what's taking you so long? Is this kind of obvious? No. And it's not obvious to them yet. They haven't hardwired the connections to understand how this stuff fits together. So then what do? You give them different perspectives and it's hard to be patient and it's hard to be kind and just let people follow their own path, but just stick with it. Like give them examples, understand their blockage and give them examples that might help them unlock it. They still may not be convinced, but at some point, like Larry Fink, case in point, at some point they come around and they look out the window and they say, oh, geez, I get it now. Now, the minute you approach that conversation in a manner that makes the person you're speaking to feel devalued, demeaned, diminished, they're just going to shut down. They're not going to want it. That doesn't invite conversation. So what's the easiest thing I think we can speak to when we're describing this to an institution? Stablecoin, you know, like the argument that Bitcoin was going to be the sucking sound that ended all fiat. It's with no hint of irony that the killer application that's being built on these digital rails is the dollar, you know, and the digital dollar. And with purpose, it couldn't get banked. You know, the digital community couldn't, crypto community couldn't get banked. So then enter stablecoin to kind of intermediate that. It was way more efficient. Your ability to hold cash, your need to hold cash comes down with the efficiency of stablecoin. So you look at that as an application. You're like, okay, that is a killer application. And the more people that engage with it will appreciate it. And then they can wrap their heads around it. They say, okay, what is this thing? It's just a programmable piece of money. And it's better than what I'm using. So why wouldn't I use this? Then all of a sudden PayPal comes out and they're like, yeah, we're integrating this into our rails because it's 26 times more efficient than what we're doing right now. No brainer, right? And they speak to it with such ease that 8 years ago, they had no interest, right? So I think it just takes time and patience. And the more user experiences that we get, that people find compelling, the better. And I think that's a little bit where, as a community, the crypto community, they'll get there. It's still very young. They'll get there, but that's where some work needs to be done.
It's interesting to approach it through stablecoins. I mean, we're seeing that in the GreenGage business that our clients are actively choosing because of effectively real-time settlement now. They can cut their costs to run business and get things more done more quickly. When do you think we'll start to see these efficiencies in the capital markets, say debt, for example? I know you're building the solution, but is this something that we're going to see slow take up? Is there going to be a big bang? Any crystal ball?
Yeah, I mean, so the interesting thing, just one bit on stablecoin, I find it interesting that you're getting traction here. Two interesting bits that just add into that just very quickly. By virtue of its high velocity and instant settlement, my cash buffers can go down. So I think of when I'm sending wires, I just need to have a certain amount of money sitting in my account just to buffer all the ins and outs. So the minute that I start using instant and final settlement as my currency mechanism, those buffers go to zero. I know if somebody's paying me tomorrow, I can use that money immediately for other purposes. So anybody that has a cash heavy balance sheet, all that cash can be put to more effective use. So it makes perfect sense. So that is mass adoption. Now, we're ultimately going to have friction between stablecoin and CBDCs. And I think ultimately stablecoin win the day, because in a crisis, everyone's going to flock to CBDC. So what's the ECB doing with that in mind? They're going to cap the amount of CBDC that an individual can hold to avoid that type of bank run. So by definition, that renders it less productive. That's going to be used for just small ticket items, bubblegum and newspapers, and coffee. This is not going to be something that scales at the wholesale level. So I think those are going to be interesting bits on the stablecoin side. On the solution, I have a slightly different perspective. Tokenization has been the buzzword for the year, I think. I think it's been by default, because post FTX, nobody wanted to say Bitcoin. Nobody wanted to say Ethereum. Nobody wanted to say layer twos. Nobody wanted to use that word. So you say, well, it's just technology, which I happen to agree with. It's just technology. And let's focus on tokenization. And then you take a step back and you're like, well, I own a bunch of bonds in traditional form. They're investments. They're not levered. I'm not going to move them around. I may sell them here and there, but for the most part, they're just going to sit there. Do I really care if it's in token form? Not really. Is the marketplace in token form better or worse? Probably worse. There's less liquidity. So if I need to sell it, I'm going back to traditional rails. So the massive efficiency unlock of that is very limited, and the cost is greater. So it's not to say that tokenization won't happen. Of course, it'll happen. It's going to happen with everything. Everything's going to trade in native or digital form, but how it happens, I think, matters a lot. So issuing a digitally native asset, I think, gives you a complete architecture in digital form. And that's when you gain the efficiencies, your legal documents, your asset, your distribution of asset, your settlement of asset. I think that, so then like mutual funds and ETFs, those two things live together for a period of time. It's not all or none. The digital side will be slow to move. You'll get a QSIP just like you would for your bonds. So if you need to migrate it over to traditional markets, you can do that. So I think that's where we end up on the capital market side. Now, before we get there, what will happen in between to demonstrate that it's worth it? It's going to be stuff that we're not doing right now. And I think of that as micropayments. The fact that I can send 1/1000th of a penny to somebody economically is just mind-blowing. That is a complete revolution in terms of how we think about getting paid. So this is exactly how adverts get paid on websites. You get these high frequency micropayments paid to Google or whomever it may be. Those are all coming to you and I in the future, because we're the ones generating those ad dollars. You're going to go directly to the source. Well, if you think of that more broadly from a gaming perspective, from whatever it may be, so AI takes off, we consume way more leisure. Leisure is going to take us to a virtual world. Virtual world is going to need virtual currencies. Those are all going to be micropayments. I want my data. I'm not going to give away my data. I want my data. That data is worth something. I think that architecture is understood. How do I control my data and the micropayments associated with them through the blockchain? And it's not to say that the blockchain is, it could be off chain with occasional interaction to the chain. Like, not to say that everything needs to be on the Bitcoin blockchain. It could live in layer twos and it could live off chain and migrate over on occasion. But that'll be an instant in time that I think will just completely shift the way we think about value creation as an individual. And I think that's a huge step. And that to me seems like a much more natural, quiet way that the crypto asset revolution takes place. And then capital markets is a bit more of a grind. It comes, but it's a bit more of a grind, because all the people who are living within those micropayments are like, okay, I want to invest this money. What can I do on chain? They're like, well, you can't. You're going to have to exit and open up a separate account and then go and buy a bond. And it's not very convenient. I would really like to have the assets available inside this virtual world that I'm living. So the assets will come over. Then you'll have a purpose for those assets to come over on chain. Whereas now it's more of an experiment.
It's super interesting the way you've outlined that. And you also think of the societal impacts. If micropayments take off, right now we're using chunky kind of payroll type. Most people are on 9-to-5 style contracts. If we think of the impact that people can have real time payments for activities, and there's no additional cost to that, again, not just the companies have more efficient balance sheets, but potentially people can plan more efficiently.
Oh my goodness! It completely revolutionizes the way we think about corporate organization, and it completely changes the nature of the relationship between the provider of a service and the employer of that service. So it's really the gig economy in the truest sense. And it'll make people happier. I mean, it's just a better state of being where you could actually have a portfolio of things you're doing. And if one of those things doesn't work out, oh, well, you just move on to another thing that you're doing. And each of those have some form of payment, some super micro payment, some chunkier than others. Some are IP because you've written a beautiful song or whatever it may be. So you have this portfolio of things you do. Well, for the individual, that's super liberating. Whereas if you think of it now, I mean, it's obviously getting lesser, but certainly I grew up in a world where people wanted to work at the same place for 50 years and get the golden ring. That's over. And I don't actually think it's healthy for people. I don't think that's what they want. That's why teachers retire at the age of 52, because they're like, yeah, I'm done. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. It's not that I'm not good at it. I just want to go do something else. Of course you do. You know, it gets a bit monotonous to teach second grade math for 32 years, right? So why not give them the scope of doing more things? And these technologies let you do that in a very, very efficient manner. So then healthcare migrates over. You can just see that future. It's just lovely. It's not utopian by any stretch. It's not this hyper-libertarian state, but it's a way more efficient and effective state for the individual. And it will force corporates to change the way they think about the people that they quote unquote employ.
We all go portfolio, so to speak. But one of the gateway products that we've been thinking through is kind of a bridge between the stablecoin and the capital markets arena in the form of yield bearing instruments, not necessarily kind of money market funds, but even tokenized deposits or something that shares some of the benefit from the profits the stablecoins are generating for the issuers with the user. Are you seeing any traction in this? Or what's the mood music from your end?
I think of it a little bit in the context of banking, and I think where the pressure is coming, which I find really interesting, narrow versus broad banking. So what do people want with narrow banking? They just want to know that they can use their money. You know, and again, this is where a stablecoin versus a traditional bank deposit can look a little bit differently. A stablecoin is a fully reserved bank, effectively. No real risk of a bank run. So long as assuming it's regulated appropriately and the asset, there's, you know, the asset liability mismatch from a duration perspective is basically zero. There may be a little bit of time gap there, but very, very little. So then you know this thing can operate 24/7. You know it's money good because you have this fully reserved system. So for people that are just looking for boring things to do with their cash, they don't care about the yield on that cash, right? They just need to know it's there to use. It could be right now, if you use largely for trading margin, it could be used for whatever. So that's kind of your current account within a narrow banking system. And then the broader banking system is where the yield stuff kicks in, where you say, okay, now I have a surplus of cash. I don't really know what to do with it. I don't really feel like hunting for these specialized investment opportunities, but I do want to generate some yield. I don't want to go too far at the risk spectrum, but I want it to generate some yield. And then you're still going to have some form of intermediation. It's not that it all goes away. You're still going to need somebody to say, all right, here's the portfolio that you may want to build to help you generate yield. That could be a bank. That could be the broader bank. And that broader bank is doing what? They're doing mortgages. They're doing all this underwriting that generates yield. And if you think of that locked capital as, well, I don't want to be locked up for 10 years, then you're going to end up in shorter duration loans that banks can underwrite and source that becomes the broader bank. And the economics of that ultimately transfer largely back to the individual. And then you have some leverage. So there you get some asset liability mismatch. Now, the provider of capital, the depositor, is very well aware that you have that mismatch. Whereas on their current account, on their narrow bank, they don't want the mismatch. They just want to know they can get their money, right? On the broader one, they'll be educated to understand that, okay, you may be locked for 5 years in the broader banking system, but you're going to take a bit more risk and you're going to earn a bit more reward. So I think that's where you start to see the separation between the two.
Maybe even from the narrow bank, you could access a product from a broad bank, so to speak. So it's a UX type interface.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you already see that for those who, I think of it almost as from a velocity perspective. So within the current account, you're going to have tiers within the current account where people may still hold the buffer for a year. And they're like, geez, I'm holding the systematic buffer. I should generate some yield on it. I can't move it over to the broad banking system because I might need that money, but I shouldn't get no yield. Whereas the person that's using this for margin capital and they're holding this thing for 16 seconds, they don't care about the opportunity cost of the yield. So I completely agree that what you will see is pressure for those yield enhancements to enter that narrow banking system as well, for sure.
We all don't just go portfolio, we become treasurers as well. I'd like to pivot the discussion somewhat. Not only do we hear some birds in the background, perhaps from your lovely place of abode, but as you're in Abu Dhabi and one in Rome, kind of COP28 has just happened, of course you would be there. I know you brought Bitcoin to COP28, which I think is fascinating. Can you tell us kind of what was your journey? How did you get there? What did you talk about?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be invited to join a panel on Bitcoin mining, effectively. And it was the first time Bitcoin has entered COP. And you're starting to see a big shift. So if you take a step back for a second, COP20, I know a lot about this. It's not, kind of not my core expertise. The 28th year of COP, and basically nothing has been accomplished. And if you get there, there's two zones. There's a green zone and a blue zone. The green zone is where the private sector innovation is happening. It is remarkable. I mean, I was blown away by the things that people are doing for the sake of just making things better. Okay, they're certainly better for the environment, but just the amount of productivity gain and innovation happening in the way we produce things, from nuclear to cars to whatever, just remarkable. I mean, just a really impressive group of people. In the blue zone is where it becomes a little bit more policy-based, so it kind of grinds you down a little bit. So you've got this division. Now, it's held by a country whose trade is dominated in fossil fuels. Next year, it's going to Azerbaijan, and like 90% of their economic activity is fossil. So the message is clear. It's like, okay, those constituents need to be at the table. They need to be part of the solution, not the problem. And this goes back to the patience and inviting discussion. You can't just chastise people and then force them to adjust. You have to invite them to the table and say, look, here's where we're trying to go. Help us get there. So that's now happening. I think it's a very, very positive element. And then tied to that, you end up Bitcoin being a COP28. I mean, it's remarkable. The fact that it was anywhere within COP28 is a massive win for the sector. And the nature of the discussion went something like this. My point of emphasis was very, very simple. Bitcoin's a commodity. Its production is very commodity-like. Like any commodity that's being produced, your edge is the feedstock. But the cheapest way we can get this stuff out of the ground and deliver it. The cheapest feedstock for Bitcoin mining is redundant energy, redundant power. Redundant power, the redundancies in the grid are always tied to green energy. So in the long term, Bitcoin is green. It's built to be green. And then you do some more digging. It's actually Satoshi's pronouncement on the public blog when he was active. He said, you know, where do I see Bitcoin mining going over time? Probably north, where it's cold and you don't need to cool down the machines and you have a ton of hydropower that's just left for dead. So even his off-the-cuff remark on the future of the carbon footprint of Bitcoin understood this point long ago. And I think that's where we head. Now, how do we get there? There's a transition path. When we first started mining Bitcoin, it was, you know, guys in their basements with a laptop computer. We were producing Bitcoin with coal. You know, there was a carbon footprint, it was meaningful and da-da-da. You can't extrapolate that, right? There's a dynamism involved here where you can't extrapolate what happened in 2012 to what's going to happen in 2032. So then you think of the amount of Bitcoin that's been produced, you have 97% of the Bitcoin is already out of the ground. You have 7% to go. Yet Bitcoin mining is becoming institutionalized. Hash rate has doubled this year. I mean, it's really remarkable the amount of capacity that's being brought online. And that is a very institutional crowd. Now that institutional crowd understands commodity production and they understand moving to the cheapest feedstock. And they see the value of that last 7% as almost infinitely greater than the value of the first 93%, which makes perfect sense. As the network becomes more deeply ingrained in the global economy, in the global financial system, naturally, it's going to become more valuable to be producing these Bitcoin, and naturally, those Bitcoin producers are going to navigate toward the cheaper feedstock that's green. So that was our main message. And then there are two micro people within the panel, and one clean energy expert as well, that added a remarkable amount of on the ground color that was quite compelling. So the audience was initially small and then it grew very quickly. They recorded it, which was super, super helpful. So then the COP people have the recording that they can go back to. And we were all buried with Q&A afterwards. I mean, hours of people wanting to discuss the issues, which I took to be very encouraging, super open-minded. it was very, very positive. Very, very positive for the crypto industry, frankly. It was a really lovely coincidence of events at COP28 for Bitcoin.
I love it. I'm really grateful for your contributions, not just for the Gauge, but for the sector generally. Is there anything you'd like to close us with? Any final comments?
No, you know, I'm really happy to have joined. Obviously, I'm a big fan of you and your work, and you exude patience. I mean, if you think of the build that you're working through, it takes a lot of grit and determination. I think that's very important. I'm just very excited to see what the future holds with this stuff. I think for the industry as a whole, I guess my big picture parting thought is we just need to have user experiences that capture people's imaginations, right? We got to stop talking less about how the car runs and the micro mechanics of the engine, and more foot on gas, vroom, vroom, isn't this fun? You know, I think we just need some user experiences that can really capture the imagination of the average audience. And I think it's off to the races. I think we'll have a lot of fun with this.
Beautifully put, Marcel. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Really appreciate it, sir.